For graduates across the country, this year is pomp and strange circumstances.
We had a virtual graduation ceremony, but it wasn't the same as actually being there in person and walking across the stage.
We talk with some grads about the tension of isolation during commencement season. It's The Takeaway for Thursday, May 14th, and I'm Shamita Basu. Also, speaking of seasons, will baseball have one? And whom will it serve?
They're already looking at losses of, say, roughly, insiders expect about $6 billion, and that's if they start in July.
But we start with a story on a community vital to so many mothers, especially during a pandemic.
Midwives are stepping in and filling a huge gap right now. If those midwives were not there in the community doing this work, like, the hospitals would be overrun right now.
The coronavirus pandemic has changed so much in our lives, from how we navigate public spaces to the way that we mourn our loved ones. It's also changing how we think about childbirth. Because of concerns about exposure to COVID-19, more and more people are moving away from hospital births to births in the home or at birthing centers with the help of midwives. Midwives are trained to deliver babies and also to assist mothers before, during, and after childbirth. Now, midwives are seeing a surge in demand across the country, but some states restrict access to their services, and that can mean a gap in care for pregnant people in rural and predominantly Black communities, where maternal health disparities already exist. For more on this, we spoke to Dr. Joya Creer Perry, founder and president of the National Birth Equity Collaborative, and Aza Nadari, a certified professional midwife based in the Washington, D.C. area. Midwifery as a profession has been around for a long time, but Dr. Creer Perry says it isn't as widely embraced today as it once was.
Well, we know in the United States, the original midwives were Black women. They were granny midwives. And unfortunately, our history of global anti-Blackness and racism plays out when you see the history of midwifery in this country and the decimation of the field and the hyper-medicalization of the delivery of babies and the birthing of babies.
Aza, you are a midwife. You're in the D.C. area. How has your work shifted in recent months since the pandemic began?
There's been a surge in interest in home birth for many people who were traditionally planning to give birth in a hospital, but have now sought out-of-hospital birth as an option, often due to cited reasons of fear of contracting COVID, concerns about the quality of care that they've been receiving. There's obviously been an uptake in Black women seeking out-of-hospital birth, but in our area, there's actually only a handful of us, meaning Black women, who work as midwives. In the DC area specifically, there are only two of us who are doing home birth. And so the options are very limited. As you can imagine, most of us are full. Some of us are full all the way through the end of the year already because people are calling when they get that first positive pregnancy test, trying to secure a midwife, knowing that the demand is significantly greater than it has been in the past.
Dr. Creer Perry, Aza is talking about the greater D.C. area there. What about nationwide? What do we know? Are people turning more to births outside of the hospital right now?
They sure are. I mean, there's data that's showing that preliminarily that we've seen at least a tenfold increase in desire for out-of-hospital and home births since COVID-19. And the fact is, we have not created a system that helps support that. And so although we know that people have been desiring different birth options for years, we never invested in having different birth options and making sure that there was a system so that if people could be prepared for a home birth, that they would know where to go if there were any kind of complications and they would have support. None of that's been developed. And so we see this desire by women that has now increased, and yet we have not invested in infrastructure to meet the need.
And Dr. Creer Perry, we have on this program been talking about the maternal health gap, especially as it relates to Black people who are giving birth. Can you talk a bit about how this pandemic is further exacerbating that gap?
what we knew and what we've been advocating around, Aza and I and others in the Black Mamas Matter Alliance, that it was racism that was causing Black women to die in childbirth, that we were dying despite income, education, access to care, that we Black women are more likely to die within a year of having a baby. Even if we have, for example, a master's or a PhD, we are more likely to die than our white counterpart who has no high school education. So the same way when it comes to weight, when it comes to obesity, Black patients who are in normal weight are more likely to die than a white patient. Interpersonal and structural racism that have impacted Black women's bodies for years, when now that we have the lack of trust and this disconnection with the health system, that those are going to be even more exposed. And so you see cases in the community who are not getting the care that they need when they are pregnant, and they are not able to avoid the biases that limit their ability to thrive in pregnancy.
Aza, how can midwives help to fill this gap that we're seeing in maternal care, especially during a moment like right now?
Midwives historically have led birth globally as well as in the U.S. I think that in our country specifically, there was a period of time when that shifted, especially in southern states where you've seen the Black midwives were eradicated out of that dynamic. And then in more recent years, you know, we start to see that number slowly start to uptake, but Black midwives still only constitute 2% of all midwives in the United States.
Can you explain what caused that shift away from favoring having midwives involved?
So it actually happened as we get kind of into the turn of the 20th century, mm-hmm. where you have obstetrical birth being touted and promoted as the gold standard for care. And that model wasn't set up and designed initially for the midwife and the OB to coexist in a dynamic, but it came at the eradication of the midwife, right? There was a whole campaign around languaging of how midwives cared for patients. And a lot of that language was that midwives were dirty and that they didn't have good hygiene. This also is undergirded by the resurgence of nurse midwifery and the onset of that. And then that exclusion of Black midwives being able to become nurse midwives, which then further led to the demise of Black midwives in the South, right? So there was parallel dynamics that were happening at the same time. It took a while for Black people to be able to then penetrate that space as well. And so you see this shift where births are moving from home to the hospital, and that becomes the norm over time. People shift to what they presume to be the gold standard for care. And so you have these two parallel tracks, and now we're kind of taking a back step where people are now saying, well, Black women are in this supposedly gold standard environment and they're receiving less care, they're receiving less quality of care, the care is not respectful, and they're dying at higher rates. And even though this has been going on for 20 years, or probably more than that, if we really dig a little bit further, the conversation in the media over the last couple of years has really amplified this issue that we've been talking about for so long. And people are seeking something different. They're looking for different types of care. They're demanding more for their care providers. People are wanting, you know, to explore midwifery as an option. The challenges with midwifery is, one, the accessibility of midwives, especially midwives that are from your community, and two, the cost. And so Medicaid across multiple states do not cover home birth and do not cover out-of-hospital birth. There are some states that do, but midwives are stepping in and filling a huge gap right now that I think is going unnoticed largely, that if those midwives were not there in the community doing this work, like, the hospitals would be overrun right now.
Dr. Kreer Perry, what do we know about improved health outcomes and midwifery? Is there data on this?
We have data to support that patients want less medicalized birth. And also, when they have a less medicalized birth provided through midwifery, they have lower rates of C-sections. They have greater rates of breastfeeding afterwards. We know that because birth has always been a communal event and it requires social support and safety, that the midwifery model of care provides those things. It was built around those tenets. What we haven't been able to unpack in the U.S. is to disengage how racism has hurt the field of midwifery, which also then hurts all of us, because we then need to build a system and be honest about how racism impacts our ability to really grow it bigger and make sure that people who are from the community, as I mentioned, are part of the workforce and are part of the field.
Asa, it's my understanding that midwifery practices are not allowed in every state, correct? And that you've been involved in some legislation recently to expand access to midwife services, especially during this pandemic?
So certified professional midwives are not legal in every state. They are legal in 35 states currently. And the District of Columbia recently passed the Certified Professional Midwife Bill. So DC is not a state. However, we will be added to that number very shortly. Nurse midwives, which are certified CNM, they are legal in all 50 states to practice. And then certified midwives, which is the other branch, they are actually trained in the same way that nurse midwives are. They just don't go the nursing pathway. They are currently legal, I believe, in about 5 states, but there is legislation that I know is pending in multiple states, or at least states where legislation is being worked on to add DMs for full scope practice as well.
Dr. Greer Perry, how do you think this moment, this pandemic, might shift how we think about birth and birth choices moving forward?
This is an amazing opportunity for us to really, I think, rethink how we built the system when we built it on the backs and on the without the exclusion of large groups of people, without even asking women what they want in birth options and how they would prefer to birth. I mean, the origins of obstetrics with J. Marion Sims and practicing on Black women who were enslaved, surgeries without anesthesia. Like, that's our history. That's our truth. And the dismantling of granny midwifery. So we have an opportunity to build something much better and bigger, and to really say people want choices. How do we create a room for people to have birth options and birth choices that are safe, from home birth to birth centers to high level acuity care when needed, and create a system that embraces a women's ability and Black women's birthing experiences and choices?
Asa, do you see it similarly? Do you see this as an opportunity as people are shifting their thinking from hospital to home births?
Absolutely. I also see this as an opportunity for us to shift the ways in which we deliver care in this country, the way in which we have conceptualized maternity care in America, and really looking at how do we create a more collaborative and comprehensive system that centers the person and that does not just center the providers in care or center money, right, as an outcome. Mm. Like, Black mamas are still dying, even when they are not COVID positive. They are dying because the quality of care that they are receiving, even during this time, is further exacerbated by the poor quality of care that was already there in the first place. You know, I look at this situation as, how do we walk away from this better, more aware that midwives are necessary to our maternity care system and structure, and that if we work together as a unit, midwives, OBs, all of the people, if we work together, that we can really create something that's beautiful, that actually works. And Dr. Joya always says this. So she says, if we get it right for Black women, we get it right for everybody, right? And I deeply believe that. I think that it has never worked for Black people. And, you know, I think that if they can't get it right, then we're going to have to get it right for ourselves, because we can't continue in this model of care that is killing us.
Asa Nadari is a certified professional midwife, and Dr. Joya Greer Perry is founder and president of the National Birth Equity Collaborative. Both of you, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
We've been thinking and talking about grief over the last couple of months, how this moment is changing the grieving process, and how to best honor those who we've lost. I'm sure you've been thinking about it also. So we're joining with our friends at the podcast Death, Sex, and Money to collect your memories and your stories about family, friends, and acquaintances who have died during this time. What's something about that person that you'll never forget? What did you learn from them? What's a funny story about them that you'd like to remember? Record a voice memo and send it to this special inbox, remembering@wnyc.org. You'll hear some of these voices on our air, and later this month, Death, Sex, and Money host Anna Sale will join us to talk about celebrating the lives we've lost during this time. It's going to be a while before baseball fans can return to stadiums to root for their home teams and cheer rivals. But this week, reports emerged that Major League Baseball is hoping to start a modified 2020 season in early July. Now, don't oil that glove just yet. The league is currently negotiating with the players' union, so nothing official has been announced. But speaking off the record to a number of media outlets, baseball officials told reporters that under the league's current proposal, the season would begin around July 4th weekend, and at least initially, games would be held without fans in attendance. On Tuesday, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey said this.
Major League sports. This includes Major League Baseball, the NBA, the NHL, the NFL, MLS are all able to participate and play in the state of Arizona after May 15th. Of course, this would be with CDC guidelines and protecting public health.
And in Illinois, Governor J.B. Pritzker voiced his frustration that negotiations over player salaries could delay an agreement to reopen Major League Baseball.
This is an important part of the kind of leisure time that all of us want to have during the summer to watch them play baseball, to root for our favorite teams. We need that back, that normalcy back, and I hope they'll be reasonable as they negotiate. But I must say I'm disappointed in many ways that players are holding out for, you know, these very, very high salaries and payments during a time when I think everybody is sacrificing.
As you can probably guess, owners versus players is going to be a big theme throughout this whole negotiation. But it's not all about the money. Players and ballpark staff will also have to weigh significant health concerns if the season starts in July. So who does this season really serve? That's a big question. Joining me now is Andy Martino, MLB reporter for SNY. Thanks for being here, Andy.
Thank you for having me.
So we mentioned that July start date. What else do we know about this proposed modified season?
Well, as you said, there would be no fans in the stands, likely for the duration. Certainly things can change with the overall health picture in the country, but it's hard to imagine a mass gathering of sports fans anytime in 2020 based on just what all of us know and have read about the coronavirus at large. Mm-hmm. So you'd have about a half of a season, 82 games, if they're able to get that off without any delays related to the coronavirus. 82 games most teams would like to play in their home stadiums. Teams whose local governments would not allow them to, or the coronavirus itself would not make that feasible, could play in their spring training parks in Florida and Arizona. You'd have an expanded playoff field, at least two more teams in the playoffs than usual, which would allow more teams and more fan bases to play more games and be televised, certainly, and collect that revenue for more televised games. You'd have a World Series that would still wrap up in late October, early November. So what it would amount to is half a season of baseball with no fans in the stands. That's the upshot.
So does this proposal mention anything about healthcare for players, for their family members, or even for the employees who would be working in the stadiums?
It does, and players have been really adamant and understandably, of course, and demanding protections and details about how their health would be protected and considered a major part of this plan. In the first virtual meeting, of course, between Major League Baseball and the Players Association, which occurred on Tuesday, the topic was mostly health and safety and not economics. We've heard a lot about the economic divide here, and we'll get to that, and that will be a major issue. But the protections for players, how can, say, a player for the New York Yankees go to his ballpark in the Bronx, play a game, be around his teammates, get on a bus to an airport, fly to, say, Atlanta, go to a hotel, eat, go to the ballpark in Atlanta, play the Braves, go home, go to another city. Oof. You see how this is all much more
just a hearing
risk.
That gives me anxiety, frankly.
Well, exactly. When we're still protecting ourselves to go to the grocery store, and you're talking about regional travel, it's significantly more than what most citizens are doing right now, frankly. So, well, details of exactly how baseball will protect its players, and as you said, not only players, but clubhouse workers, bus drivers, pilots, everyone who's involved in this, details have been scarce so far, but were presented in broad form to the Players Association on Tuesday. It will involve significant testing, perhaps daily temperature checks, frequent testing of players and staff. Beyond that, we're still gathering details of what was presented and what will be presented.
Andy, maybe just asking this question will reveal how little of a baseball fan I personally am, but why is there such a push to play this season and not skip it altogether?
Well, it's a great question. And for a person who's not excited about the sport, it would be understandable to ask, why are we rushing this? What is the big deal? And that is a reasonable question. As with most big business or all big business, the ultimate answer is money. This is a $10 to $12 billion a year industry. They're already looking at losses of, say, roughly, insiders expect about $6 billion, and that's if they start in July. Your players who make millions of dollars, agents who make commissions off of those salaries, owners who depend on the revenue. So you have a whole economic system, and they're motivated to get that started. Then there's an argument that's a little bit more ephemeral about the American public's fascination with baseball over the years and ability to get into it and be distracted by it, and how nice it might be to be able to turn on your television and watch the Yankees play the Red Sox, even with no fans in the stands. It would be something for us to rally around. And while that's nice, and as a fan of the game myself, I would love to watch the sport, I wouldn't ignore the economic argument too. It's a big industry.
A number of politicians have weighed in on the possibility of baseball starting back up. How much political support does there seem to be for a July start date? Because it feels like a lot.
Don't underestimate, generally speaking, politicians' interest in using sports as a rallying cry. Governor Pritzker's comments about players holding out were not accurate, in that players just received a proposal. They're not holding out. They're simply negotiating. But I think his comments reflected the spirit of a lot of politicians. Governor Cuomo in New York, of course, Democrat, has been saying for weeks that he would like to see baseball if it were safe and possible. So I think you're going to find political support. Rob Manfred, who's the commissioner of Major League Baseball, has been on the phone with governors. He's spoken on the phone with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. There's been overall a sense on the political side of support and working with the league, with the NBA as well, to figure out how they can resume, if they can resume.
Andy, can you explain what a revenue split is and how it factors into what's being discussed right now?
So the Major League Baseball Players Association, their union, has long been the strongest union in sports, and they resisted any effort by the league to institute any kind of salary cap. And their position is that revenue sharing is a type of salary cap, or leads to a salary cap, because, of course, it would be capped on the amount of revenue that the leagues earn. There's a significant amount of distrust between the union and the league in this case. Decades of distrust. They've had a strike. They've had multiple work stoppages. And the union, frankly, doesn't trust that they will get an accurate picture from the owners of what revenue is. They want to know what's the pie that they're getting a piece of. They don't see the books of things like a television revenue and various revenue streams. So it's going to be tough for them to feel comfortable agreeing to a revenue split when they don't feel like they know what the revenue is. The owner's position is a prorated salary for half a season is not enough of a pay cut to make a season economically feasible. Both sides are portraying their positions as intractable right now. But for them to play, something's going to have to give, and both sides are motivated economically to play.
In South Korea, professional baseball teams have started playing games. No fans are in the stands. That just started this month. Is there anything that the MLB might be able to learn from how baseball is operating in South Korea right now?
Well, optically, what we've learned from watching that on TV is that it can work as a television production. Anecdotally, you watch the game. You're a little bit taken aback by the fact that it's a quieter stadium with no fans. You have a tighter zoom on the camera than we're used to, generally, and we watch the game. And it feels like you're watching a baseball game. But in terms of the logistics of the travel and all the stuff that I detailed in the previous segment that sounded like a lot, I don't know how much we can learn from South Korea, because as we know, more broadly, the virus has been contained. For better or worse, the government in different countries where the virus has been contained have taken a different approach. And we're simply at a different place in the curve with the coronavirus in the U.S. Than other countries are. And that's really what it seems to come down to. So I think the lessons from how another country is undertaking this are limited because of the difference in where the virus is.
Andy, we have about a minute left, but I want to ask a sort of big question, which is, who does a modified season really serve? Is this for the players? Is it for the fans? Is it for the owners?
That's a great question, and you can make a case for how it serves all three. The players and the owners economically, and the fans for entertainment, and the group that obviously assumes the most risk and therefore could be served the least, ultimately you'd have to say, are the players and the staff, who are the ones who are out there putting themselves at risk. And this is the crux of the economic argument too, frankly. The players feel like they deserve hazard pay rather than a pay cut. And the owners are making their own revenue argument. But all parties would benefit. And those who are out on the front lines would be the ones who would be, of course, at risk. And not to mention the families of the players and the staff who whose homes would not be as secure if they're their husbands and wives are going out to work and coming home and bringing home those extra germs and risk from being out working.
Andy Martino is a Major League Baseball reporter for SNY. Thank you so much, Andy.
Thank you.
You can find a statement from Major League Baseball on their reopening plans online at thetakeaway.org. And we also wanted to get a sense of how minor league baseball players have been affected by COVID-19. So we reached out to a former minor leaguer and longtime advocate for these players.
This is Garrett Brushhouse, an attorney at Corine Tillery in St. Louis and one of the co-founders of Advocates for Minor Leaguers.
Garrett says many minor leaguers are struggling financially because of the shutdown, but they are getting some support from Major League Baseball until at least the end of May.
You know, luckily, MLB did the right thing initially and said, hey, you know what? You know, normally we would be paying you once the season starts, and now the season is suspended. So we're going to pay you $400 per week as a stipend.
But this is all happening at a particularly challenging moment for minor league baseball.
Now, at the same time that MLB is negotiating this reopening of the major league season, they're also negotiating with minor league baseball over the possible closure of 42 minor league teams. That's 25% of minor league baseball. You know, the closure of 42 minor league teams means 1,000 less minor league baseball player jobs. Major League Baseball had announced that intended plan all the way back in the fall, and minor league baseball was fighting it vigorously. But what has changed is it appears that minor league baseball isn't fighting the possible closure of those 25% of its teams as hard now. And so the minor league baseball landscape in 2021 could look very, very different than the landscape in 2020.
Former minor league baseball player Garrett Brushhouse. We'll see what happens. This is The Takeaway.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC. Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Recent polls from CNN, The Washington Post, Ipsos, and 538 say that more than 50% of Americans disapprove of how President Trump and his administration have responded to the pandemic. And when you talk about polls, you got to talk with Amy Walter, the host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway on Fridays, and the national editor of the Cook Political Report. Amy, thank you for coming on a day earlier than usual.
I'm very glad to be here, Shamita. Thank you.
So let's talk about this one CNN poll. One stat that caught my eye, it says 36% of Americans say they trust what Donald Trump tells them about coronavirus, and his approval rating is hovering around 45%. So in other words, some of his supporters don't trust or believe him, but they still support him. Is that a fair interpretation of these numbers? What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's a really excellent question, because I think it comes back to the sort of central reality of the Donald Trump presidency, which is there's so much about him that's already kind of baked into the cake. right? Mm-hmm. Things that we know about him that you've either accepted or that continue to make you crazy about him. And you can't understand why they don't make other people crazy. And so there is this tendency then to say, well, if people think he's doing, for example, a bad job on handling the COVID crisis, or they don't trust him to have all the answers, why do they still think he's doing a good job as president? There are two reasons. One, they say, well, I think he'd do a better job than a Democrat, and I can't vote because I think Democrats are terrible across the board, or I don't like Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. Or we already knew this about him. He does this kind of stuff. He says stuff, blah, blah, blah. But overall, I think it's going to be better, and I'd rather have him doing this than somebody else.
And have his approval numbers changed since the pandemic began?
It's pretty remarkable if you look back over time at the president's approval rating, even going back to the very first moment he was sworn in as president. His approval ratings have really never gone above 48%, right, but they've never dropped below 35%. And that very narrow range, we call it his trading range, has been pretty historic. We've never seen anything like this. Most presidents come in with at least something of a honeymoon. This president did not have one. He got 46% of the popular vote. He came into office with 46% approval rating. Even on this crisis where we've seen governors across the country with a bump up in their approval ratings, mm-hmm, that hasn't happened to this president. Got a little bit of a bump, maybe 2 or 3 points, but certainly not the kinds of bumps that we've seen for governors who in some cases are seeing approval ratings in the 70s or 80s. But at the end of the day, just as we started this conversation, opinions about this president are so hardened, and about what they want for the country are so hardened, mm-hmm, that it is difficult to see that breaking.
You know, the recent White House coronavirus press briefings have been at times hard to watch for me, and I think for a lot of other people, with Trump lashing out at reporters, very noticeably women, and very noticeably mostly women of color. Talk about the things that are baked in. I mean, do you have a sense of whether that is affecting how people see the president right now, or is that sort of staying where it is?
The more that the president is in the spotlight with these press conferences, I think that has been a detriment to him and his overall approval ratings. As I said, they don't move all that much. The only question is whether they're at the higher end of that trading range or the lower end. And I think when the president is in front of the cameras, when he has these press conferences where he's fighting with reporters, where he's singling out women, that is when you see his numbers start to move toward the lower end. Not mm-hmm. because people have necessarily changed their minds about the president, but for those folks who are sort of leaning towards Trump, who are maybe ambivalent about the president, it pushes them into the category of, I don't know, I don't feel mm-hmm. great about what this president's doing. When he moves out of the spotlight, when we don't see as much focused on the president per se, you see his numbers moving up a little bit. And it's really funny because that's what we saw in 2016 as well. Mm. When the spotlight was on Hillary Clinton, on the emails, on her health scare, you saw her numbers dip down and Trump's go up. When Trump was in the spotlight, you saw Hillary Clinton's numbers move up, or at least Trump's move down. And so, interestingly enough, the president, the less he's in the spotlight, the better he does. But we know with this president, he does not want to be out of the spotlight. He will not be disciplined enough to take himself away from being that polarizing figure.
So does that mean that, I'm thinking of Joe Biden as you're talking, and sort of being out of the spotlight as a strategy, perhaps. But generally, really, where is Joe Biden? It feels like he's been rather quiet, or maybe just eclipsed. Right. And I've seen the hashtag "Where is Joe" has trended on Twitter a couple of times. What does this mean for Joe Biden?
That's right. So there are competing theories here, especially among the Democratic chattering class and that group of sort of armchair pundits who say, well, maybe it'd be better for Joe Biden to stay in his basement in Wilmington versus those who say he needs to go out and make this contrast with Trump. He's being overshadowed. Mm. I think, you know, there's a truism in politics as in life in general, which is if it's not broken, don't fix it. Right. And right now, Joe Biden is enjoying leads over the president anywhere from 4 to 6 points nationally. He is in very good position in these battleground states. In some cases, he's ahead by a couple of points, which essentially means the race is a toss-up. That's not a bad place to be against an incumbent president. So in that sense, sort of staying quiet and staying in your basement makes a lot of sense. At the same time, we do know that voters at some point are going to want to hear from the person who could be their president. And mm-hmm. the idea that you could run an entire campaign from your basement seems kind of ridiculous.
I mean, we are 6 months away from the presidential election. I keep on forgetting that, but it's only 6 months.
That's right. That's right. And so you do need to, at some point, hear from him, which could put then even more pressure on these debates in the fall. And look, we know we can do a debate with two candidates, regardless of where we are in this pandemic. The fact is the two of them could be social distant on a stage, no one in the audience, and a social distant moderator that would work, which would be something that, you know, would be quite risky, I think, for Joe Biden, and that to go from being in your basement and not getting a lot of attention to the spotlight and all the pressure is on you for this one or two debate performance, that I think is a riskier pronouncement. But again, this is a referendum on the president, and the more that the Biden campaign and the attention is on the president, I think that is better for Joe Biden than if the attention is on him. Because remember, the other thing that's not happening, nobody's defining Joe Biden. The media is not spending a whole lot of time digging into Joe Biden. We had the Tara Reid allegations and the back and forth there. If this were a regular time in the before time, there would be about 47 different pieces a day digging into different aspects of Joe Biden's history and his voting record. That's not happening. Instead, he gets to just sort of be frozen in time. And for now, that's been a good thing for him.
Amy Walter is the host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway and the national editor of the Cook Political Report. Amy, thank you for joining me.
So glad to do it.
And hey, you know that Amy is in the host chair as usual tomorrow on Politics with Amy Walter. You can listen to it live when it airs, or if you're a podcast person, grab it on the podcast at thetakeaway.org or anywhere that you get your podcasts. Across the country, students are preparing for a defining moment in their lives, graduation. It's an exciting and sort of stressful time, and it's all building up to that moment when you finally cross the stage and receive your diploma. But during a global pandemic and amid stay-at-home orders, graduation this year is looking pretty different.
So we had a virtual graduation ceremony, and I got to see my name scroll up on the screen, but it wasn't the same as actually being there in person and walking across the stage.
That's Zipporah Osei, a journalism major who just graduated from Northeastern University in Boston. Zipporah is a first-generation graduate, meaning she's the first in her family to graduate from college. And although her college commencement ceremony was a big deal for her family,
for me, at least, it felt underwhelming. So I haven't really had the sense yet of my college experience is over, because I don't feel like that moment has sunk in for me yet.
To understand how first-generation students around the country are grappling with all of this, we spoke with Zipporah and two other college seniors.
My name is Marisa Sanchez. I just recently graduated from St. Edward's University in Austin, Texas, and I got my degree in social work, and I minored in psychology.
My name is Nicholas Stewart, and I am a geology major, and I graduate this coming summer, so August, and I go to the University of South Florida.
For Marisa, Zipporah, and Nicholas, it wasn't just their upcoming graduation that was stressing them out, but shifting to online learning. And tensions are still high.
when all this first started, I was really anxious and really worried about how everything was going to play out. But I think now I've kind of gotten into a routine of trying to practice self-care, doing yoga, going on walks, calling my family frequently. So I think as of right now, I'm doing okay. I think just okay as to be expected in a time like this.
That makes sense. Zipporah, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I think there's definitely been some highs and lows throughout the past couple weeks. Everything was so hectic when campuses first closed and classes moved online that I think there wasn't a ton of time to process what was going on. But by mid-April, I think it really sunk in that this was going to be for the long haul and that this was going to change things pretty drastically. And so it's taken some adjusting, and there are definitely days that are better than others, but I'm doing okay for the most part.
That's good to hear. Nicholas, how are you holding up?
I am very hopeful, yet I'm very nervous because of everything that just happened. Like everyone else said, it's been a very hectic situation, and it's becoming a new normal for us. So it's like how we're getting to like have a sense of normality during this time, especially given that it was our senior year, a year that we've waited 4 years or less or more for. But I'm very hopeful.
And Zipporah, you are a first-generation student. You all are first-generation students. But tell me, for you, how has that shaped your experience of your senior year, and how's it shaped your expectations for what you want graduation to be?
I've thought a lot about graduation, graduating college since I was in high school, just because I think everyone can agree when you're a first-generation student, there's a lot of pressure once you get into college to finish it and to try to do it in the most traditional ways possible so that you can feel like you've done it the way everybody else has. And so I was really excited to graduate and to really make the most of my senior year. And I do think before all of this started, I was having a great year. And by senior year, I felt that I was comfortable in my surroundings on campus and had people that I could really lean on at my university. So it definitely was a little disappointing to have the ending of my college career changed so suddenly.
Marissa, what about for you?
Being a first-generation student, I kind of like really identify with that, and coming into college, just being so grateful for having the opportunity. I think my family really kind of instilled that gratefulness in me from a young age that education is such a privilege. And throughout my 4 years at St. Ed's, I've always tried to do my best. I've always pushed myself extra hard because I knew that there was that pressure. And I agree, it was kind of very disappointing when they decided to go online and everything had to change the way it was, because it kind of felt like everything we had worked for, even though that's not like the case, it felt like everything we worked for was kind of just like, okay, you got here, and now it's like, just kidding, no you didn't, you still have to wait, or you don't get a graduation. Or it just kind of felt like a big prank, even though I know that's not what it is. That's kind of what it felt like as a first generation student.
Nicholas, what about for you? You're a first gen student, and your family, most of your family, from what I understand, is in Jamaica. What was your setup going into this senior year and thinking about graduation?
I was studying abroad in Australia in the fall, but when I came back, it was different because everyone grew. Everyone was like doing their own things. And I think being a first generation student, it's like your degree, I look at it as not only for me, it's for my nieces, it's for my cousins, it's for my aunt, it's for my mom, it's for my dad. Mm-hmm. These are people who've never gotten their degrees yet. And it's something that it's heavy, like everyone said, it's something, a heavy burden to carry. But I think I don't know, I still remain true that I'm still getting this degree, and it's just a victory lap, even though we may have not graduated in a traditional setting per se. It's a bittersweet moment.
I'm sure. And, you know, senior year as a college graduate, there's so many other celebratory events also happening on campus and off campus, ways that you might be celebrating with your friends or through your university or colleges. How have you all been sort of filling that gap, the social celebratory aspect?
I kind of have been doing a lot of Zoom calls with friends, and like on graduation day, I had a Zoom call with a group of my friends, and we kind of watched the virtual celebration together.
Marissa, was on Saturday, right? Over the weekend?
Yeah, it was over the weekend on May 9th. So we did that. I've also been, I created a petition to get the graduation ceremony held in person when like everything was healthy. And I've been actually actively working with the university and the administration to plan events, hopefully in December, if not later, if it has to be pushed back again. But I kind of just really wanted to advocate for all of the first generation students and with other people who have worked so hard to get to where we are and just have that in-person graduation. So I think that putting that passion that I have into getting a celebration, that's kind of what I've been doing in place of actually celebrating.
And Nicholas, your graduation is planned for August,
yes.
But you're not sure if it's going to be canceled yet or held in person or held in a virtual sense. What are your plans?
I would love to be in the atmosphere with like everyone and just being like saying, yes, I've made it, because it's like a big moment, and graduation is like a place where you see everyone celebrating, crying, laughing, and just celebrating yourself. If it doesn't happen, I completely understand given the circumstances that we're under, but it's very sad in a sense.
I think all of you have mentioned your families at some point in this conversation, and I know that your families enter into this graduation milestone in such a major way, especially so if you're first generation. Marissa, I understand that you and your brother both graduated college, being the first ones in your family to do so. What does this accomplishment mean for your family?
It means a lot. It means a lot. I think I actually watching like the different virtual commencements, I got really emotional, and I feel that when we do finally get to be in person, I'm going to be emotional. I'm just going to be very emotional because it means so much to me and to my family, and it makes them proud of me, and to feel that they're that proud of me kind of just gives me that sense of encouragement to move forward and to go on and continue my education. I'm actually going to go on and get my master's now, and I'll be the first in my family to go on to graduate school. So that just means so much to them and to me. I know that they were all really looking forward to coming to Austin. My grandma would call me every week and tell me that she was going shopping with my mom looking for an outfit, and none of them had been to Austin before. So I know that it was just something that they are so proud of me for, and just feeling that sense of accomplishment really brings it makes me very emotional and makes me very happy to know that I can do that for my family.
I hope your grandma still gets to show off her graduation outfit on a Zoom call or something with your family. You'll find a way to enjoy that together. Nicholas, tell me, because knowing that your family or a lot of your family is in Jamaica, how were you planning to celebrate together? What does this mean for them?
I mean, words cannot describe, because my mom, my dad, my whole family was going to come over from Jamaica, from New York, from Fort Lauderdale to come and celebrate me, because this is a milestone that I never thought I would achieve in like a million years, because that is not something that has been on the forefront. Because when my mom sent me over here, she sent me to work, and for me to like be able to graduate with a college degree and wanting to pursue further towards my PhD is their wildest dreams being actualized, you know?
Mm-hmm. Zipporah, what about for you? What did this mean for your family?
I think this was going to be a really important moment for my family, and it still is, even though we're celebrating it in different ways. My mom is originally from Ghana, and she immigrated to the U.S. Before she had me and my siblings, and so for us, I think it's always been the emphasis is, you know, get your education and work as hard as you can, because I'm working as hard as I can to make sure that that's possible for you. And I think now more than ever, with everything going on, I really appreciate the sacrifices and the work that she's put into me being able to get a degree. She's a healthcare worker in New York, and so she's obviously working really hard, and it's a reminder to me that she's been working as hard as she is now for my entire life.
You know, this is such a difficult time to graduate from college. I know I don't need to tell you. I'm sure this is top of all of your minds. How are you adjusting your plans for the future?
I can start. This is Marissa. I have been in contact with the graduate school that I'm planning on attending. And we've kind of just had the conversation of if things go online in the fall, Would I be able to defer or not? So they are allowing people to defer into the fall of 2021. So if things are looking like they're going to go online in the fall, I think that I'm going to defer and then find a job as a social worker with my and get my BSW license and kind of just work for a year and accumulate some funds so that I can pay for graduate school on my own and have the means to do so. So just kind of planning for that. And probably in that time, I'll move home to New Mexico and work with in Santa Fe with my family.
I really agree with Marissa. It's like putting everything on a hold, like a push back, because I had gotten into this very pristine internship through my university, which is a WASH program, where I was supposed to go to Ghana this summer to like work with like WASH initiatives over there, and even like studying for my GRE and applying for like master's programs and like aligning myself to like push myself forward into like the working force. It's definitely on a standstill because of the whole coronavirus situation.
Of course. And when you say WASH program, that's water, sanitation, and hygiene?
Yes.
Right, yeah. Zipporah, what about for you? How are you thinking of your future plans? Have you had to change anything?
I do feel fortunate in that before all of this started, I confirmed a fellowship with ProPublica through the Scripps Howard Foundation. So I will have a job for the next year, and that's something that I feel really, really grateful for. What I think really has been brought to mind is trying to learn and plan to be more flexible after the fellowship ends, because I know we're heading into a recession and the journalism industry is going through some changes because of everything that's going on with coronavirus. And so that's scary for me, just having student loans and wanting to be able to live and have a job after all of this is over. I want to be as flexible as possible. And it's also throughout my whole college career, it's been really important to me to try to make plans that allow me to be kind of self-sustaining, because I don't have kind of the safety net that some other students may have.
With so much going on in the world, what gives you hope right now? What's making you smile right now?
This is Marisa. I can go first. I think my family, they are kind of my rock, and my friends and my partner and everything, just the people that are closest to me. I really know that they are with me and they're with the people, and it kind of gives me hope to know that there are good people out there and there are people who are out there advocating for the needs of people. I think that's what's giving me hope.
I would agree. I definitely have been leaning on the people in my support system, my friends and my family, and even professors who I know are always going to be supportive of me throughout my career. And I think on a larger scale, what is giving me hope is the potential for change when we get out on the other end of this. I think people are really starting to examine what works and what doesn't work. And I think that there is room for some change in our future.
Coming in and understanding that we started everything with a purpose, like 4 years ago, whether it be like our degrees or like whatever you're doing, and it's still remaining mindful and driven with that purpose and still staying passionate about it. I think that's what's keeping me hopeful, knowing that I have an end goal.
Nicholas Stewart, Marissa Sanchez, and Zipporah Osei are first-generation students who are graduating this spring. Congratulations to all of you. I really hope you get a chance to celebrate and feel your accomplishments. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Friends, that's it for me today. Amy Walter is in tomorrow as usual, and I'll be back next week. Before we go, a quick shout out to the great team that makes this show each and every day. Our board operator, Debbie Daughtry, was in the studio at WNYC for us alongside Vince Fairchild, who was our director this week. Thank you both. Working from home was line producer Jackie Martin and editor Jay Cowett in the mornings. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. Our producers are Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Amber Hall and Patricia Jacob are our politics producers. Polly Irungu is our digital editor. Katerina Barton is our intern, and David Gable is our executive assistant. Lee Hill is our executive producer. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Shamita Basu, and this is The Takeaway.